Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
It's one thing to go and protest the corrupting influence of all this wealth on Wall Street. It's another thing to go and protest the government being corrupted by that wealth.
David Swanson joins us to talk about Occupy Wall Street as protesters arrive in the nation's capital, widening their occupation nationally to include a plaza near K Street and the hangout of highly paid Washington lobbyists who often seem to have more impact on legislation than Americans do. The plaza will be renamed Liberty Plaza, and you can learn more at the website October2011.org or davidswanson.org. David Swanson is author of the book War is a Lie and the more recent title Daybreak in America. David Swanson, welcome.
Good to be here.
And with all this hoopla about the demands of the Occupy Wall Street movement, do you think you have your demands in order, David?
I do. And I have nothing but tremendous pride and admiration for the accomplishments of the people at Occupy Wall Street in having refused to reduce their demands to a single bumper sticker. I mean, nothing drives me crazier. You cannot fix the problems of the world on a bumper sticker. We have to redirect our priorities in our government. So that means we have to stop tax breaks for the wealthy. We have to tax the super rich and the corporations. We have to cut this dumping of 59% of discretionary spending into the military machine. We have to put money into places where it creates jobs and sustainable environmental policies and the rest of it. We have to protect our social safety net. I could go on for a few more minutes and I still wouldn't have hit like 100th of the length of the instructions for a Blu-ray player, which every American seems capable of handling. You know, the idea that it has to, you know, be in 8 seconds is just not logic to it. Our demand is that the majority of the people be listened to, and the plutocrats who make up the upper 1% stop getting to run the show and decide everything in Washington and New York. And I think that focus of put the power back on the people rather than this corporate plutocracy encompasses a package of reforms that are badly needed.
And David Swanson, about this whole issue of the media's take and what will they think and what will they do and having to have the right lingo and logo and all that, it seems to me that as we enter into yet another political fervor here, looking at the White House and the presidency, they really are seeing, you know, in excess of $1 billion set of campaigns being waged here. The media is obviously going to have high price time for sale. The Obama administration utilized the internet in a very sophisticated way. Bloggers really helped to create his logo, his vision, if you will, as it was translated through his many supporters who wept when he was inaugurated. And what I'd like to just have you comment on finally is, do you think there will ever come a time when he and his, you know, handlers will look at Occupy Wall Street and say, you know what, those are my people?
It's not something I think about, the psyche of the president. Maybe I should, but it seems that with the entire rest of the world doing it, my little bit might not add that much. I think about how we can compel the president and the Congress to listen to majority opinion. You know, I don't think that in his heart of heart, the president wishes he were with us, but it's just difficult. And I don't think there's much value in trying to decide whether that's really true or not. I don't think it means much of anything. I think what's necessary is for those of us who were raising hell and protesting night and day when George W. Bush was engaged in outrageous behaviors, be willing to do the same when Obama is. If we had not shut down the movement for peace and justice in December of 2008, think of how much better off we would be right now. And that's what's encouraging to me about this moment, is seeing people on Wall Street and around the country and preparations for October2011.org coming to D.C., being willing to say, we're the people, you're the government, aside from parties and personalities, because when we get into parties and personalities, people routinely invert the way representative government is supposed to work. They're supposed to be our public servants. People act as if we are the servants of some party or some individual politician, and we should be rooting for them and working for them. And it's such a backwards approach. It's not that we're against elections. You know, the New York Times would have you believe that if you're for protesting, you're against voting. You know, a lot of the demands of the protest movement are for the reforms that would allow us to have elections. You know, Barack Obama took $39 million from these financial interests. He's the top taker from Wall Street in the history of the country. And we would like to get that money out of there, get the gerrymandering out of there, get the corporate media watchdogs out of there, get verifiable voting machines. We'd like to have elections. But we don't think just waiting around and voting for the lesser of two horrible choices in each of the next elections is going to be enough to do that. We think something else has to be injected into the system, and it's something that the corporate media doesn't want, and it doesn't have the same interest in that it has in all of that money it takes from the elections, but they can be brought along with everybody else.
Now, one of the chances, you know, we are the 99%. And let's look at that for a minute, because I think, you know, the 1% have been hoarding and collecting the world's resources for decades. They've gotten very good at this. And now it seems the 99% are forming these ad hoc global movements to try to take it back. And what they're really saying is that, you know, we feel instinctively that the majority is with us, not the 1%, because let's face it, the 1% has democracy. The 99%, of which I consider myself one, do not. So in other words, they bought it. We had it stolen from us just like we had our, you know, retirement stolen, really.
Yeah, I don't know how they run their gatherings, you know, the Koch brothers meetings and the Bilderberg groups and the Bohemian Forest gangs. You know, I don't know if they have democracy among themselves when they come to their decisions, but we don't have democracy nationally. We have elected officials sold to the highest bidder. We have gerrymandered districts. We have an electoral college system so that for the most part, you know, your vote really does not count. I mean, it's actually a rational decision that your sole vote, except for the example it sets and the principle it upholds, doesn't actually count. And we should have democracy. We should have representative government. All of the positions that we, the 99%, are bringing to Wall Street and Washington, they're not 99% positions, but most of them are 75% positions. They're majority positions. We want to tax the rich. We want to tax the corporations in major ways. We want to end the wars, bring the troops home, cut the military spending, protect our safety net, give everybody health coverage like a decent civilized nation does, and the corporate welfare, put our money where we choose to put it, into good nonviolent jobs, into green energy, into transportation, protect our rights, our civil liberties, our rights in the workplace, and pass the reforms necessary so that we can have elections and elections can mean something. And much of this agenda is shared by just about everybody. I mean, it's over 85% saying the system's broken, you know, and some people would rather have tax cuts and some people would rather have money invested in education. But all of us agree that they are on the wrong path now. And so it is a good moment to try something new where we're not rallying, we're not speechifying, we're not marching, but we're occupying.
And it's not really run by pundits either. I mean, they are supportive. They're, you know, they're joining, but it's not led by some of the intellectuals in the United States. It's more or less an amalgam of kids, of workers, of grandparents, of grandmothers, you know, and that's what I've liked about some of the coverage where they've actually realized that, you know, on some of the major networks. And I would cite, for example, in a positive way, you know, MSNBC and our local affiliate station here in Connecticut, Channel 30, noticing what's going on at Occupy Wall Street. Now, I want to ask you about workers and unions here, because when the media covers this, I think they're starting to recognize that if unions are supporting these people, maybe they're not able to be so easily marginalized. So how important is it that the labor unions came out and said, hey, we're with Occupy Wall Street?
It's very important, and it's very helpful that the community organizers and the leftist agitators and center and right agitators groups of active duty soldiers and Marines and the big sort of insider partisan online groups from MoveOn.org on across that spectrum are now joining in and supporting Occupy Wall Street, and they're going to have a big march on Wednesday and so forth, and Van Jones and the Take Back the Dream gang are expressing support for Occupy Wall Street. I think it's very significant that a group of people, young and old, who have, you know, in some cases not had enough years to be corrupted by the sort of influences that get to most of us, and have see themselves as having not that much to lose. They're up to their ears in debt. They have no jobs. You know, have been willing to push this thing with an uncomfortable coalition in difficult circumstances, taking risks, facing abuse, to the point where these groups are compelled to get on board or look like they don't care. The big question in that regard, I think, is going to be whether such groups, whether the labor movement and these other groups that tend not to challenge one of the two parties in our government, continue or expand on that support as the occupation comes to Washington, D.C., starting on October 6th with October2011.org, because, you know, it's one thing to go and protest the corrupting influence of all this wealth on Wall Street. It's another thing to go and protest the government being corrupted by that wealth. But we are going to go and challenge the servants of Wall Street on K Street, in the Pentagon, in our government, in our nation's capital. And, you know, corruption is not something that just gets imposed on poor, helpless victim Congress members and presidents. It's an active choice. So I hope that we can bring together in this moment the activist, principled left and others who challenge abuses in our government with the more insider establishment, cozy up to one of the two parties types. If we can bridge that divide, and if Wall Street can help bridge that divide in Washington, and if people can start challenging the government as the people, confronting the government, rather than this whole partisan routine, we will have made huge strides.
Well, you talked about Wall Street bridging the gap. Let's define what the American economy consists of, because in many ways, for all practical purposes, it consists of Wall Street. I mean, just in terms of what gets protected, right? Because it seems as if what they call social service programs are on the table at all times, whereas corporations are, you know, constantly getting the benefit of enthusiasm from the White House. You know, a visit from the White House to a corporation or a factory or some kind of incentive program, or, you know what I mean? It's like, by all means, keep those tickers going up, you know, instead of down. And it's like, rescue them because they're our economy. What is our economy? Because it always seemed to me that's held in the hands of the American people.
It's overloaded with national and international monopolies and conglomerates that are, you know, deemed too big to fail. It's overloaded with financial corporations that don't produce anything but more financing. It's an economy that's moving away from producing tangible goods, and not just into services, but into bankster paperwork. And these biggest corporations on Wall Street, which produce nothing, are bailed out at taxpayer expense, are helped along by the Federal Reserve in ways that nobody else is. That our government has a responsibility, the Federal Reserve has a responsibility to address unemployment. But unemployment apparently is not considered a crisis. The difficulties of Wall Street firms that have destroyed the rest of the economy and are in danger themselves is deemed a crisis, and we are supposed to bail them out. And Americans are against that approach across the political spectrum overwhelmingly. And so it's important that this pressure has been brought on Wall Street and that it continue. But it's also significant that Occupy Wall Street, despite being there in New York, has been addressing militarism and the war economy, which is a growing part of our economy and is something that people think of as, in economic terms, as producing jobs, and addressing this crisis we are in that really can only be solved by taxing the rich or cutting the military waste, one or the other or both. And the military for decades has wanted to go after Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. That's where there's piles of money. And Wall Street, of course, shares that interest in wanting to privatize that money. And Wall Street and the rest of the corporate oligarchs, of course, need that threat around the world of military aggression to support the ways in which they're exploiting the resources, including the human resources of other countries. So you can't separate Wall Street from the Pentagon. And to have a protest that is going after both together is remarkable and has been needed for quite some time.
And it's interesting to see the variety of ways that people are asking what is really the same question. You know, do people matter anymore? Do the American people come first? Or is it, you know, the war operation, Wall Street, and the banks?
Well, that's the big question. Do they? We will see. And of course, we matter if we make ourselves matter, if we speak up on our own behalves and take risks and insist that we will continue to do so for the long haul, even if we don't win in our lifetimes, then we will matter, as movements in the past have managed to matter. Movements that have won the vote for women and other groups, movements that have won civil liberties and workers' rights and environmental protections have operated without this sort of narcissistic obsession that dominates activists today, where we wonder, are we supposed to be optimistic or pessimistic this week? Are we winning or not winning? Is everything going to be fixed by next month or not? You know, I mean, it strikes me as absolutely immoral. I mean, we need to be working to make people matter and to take control of this country, whether it looks like we're about to win or we never will. I mean, there's no other choice, and it's much more enjoyable than not doing so, and sitting back and griping about it or tweeting about it. We really have no better option for how to behave decently and how to enjoy ourselves than to begin to act. And I think this notion of calling these movements occupations, you know, it sounds inappropriate. Isn't occupation a terrible thing? But the contrast between a nonviolent people's occupation on the model of Tahrir Square, of Tunisia, of Wisconsin, is in contrast to and can be used to highlight the fact that we have U.S. troops occupying in an antagonistic manner most of the countries on the planet, that we are wasting hundreds of billions of dollars, that we have hundreds of thousands of troops occupying people's countries who, for the most part, do not want them there, and that this is damaging us. And so it's not a trade-off between this militaristic imperial policy regarding foreign relations and our safety. You know, we don't have to weigh the economic costs against how much it's keeping us more safe or anything else. It is making us much less safe. And it is destroying the natural environment. You know, the military is the number one polluter and destroyer of our natural environment. It is destroying our civil liberties. We now have Americans lumped in with everybody else as open targets for murder by our government. There are 18 downsides, including the economic, to what we are doing. And the top concern for me personally is that we are killing large numbers of people, almost all of them non-Americans. There's just no upside to be weighed against it. So we need to prosecute crimes of terrorism as crimes, and we need to engage with the world nonviolently. And if in the process we save trillions of dollars and redirect it to useful purposes and or tax cuts, so much the better.
When you look at what's happening, you know, from Italy to Greece and Germany too, we see people protesting, right? But they seem to have been pushed out of the process going on all around them that has to do with austerity programs they have to accept or taxes they have to donate. And it really seems beyond their control and reach. And so we might say that the people at Wall Street that are from so many different backgrounds are occupying a space that Wall Street has, you know, commanded authority over for all these decades. Right now, the park, it's being called Liberty Park, is actually something that's property owned by Brookfield's Properties. And Brookfield is a big conglomerate of investment, real estate, and all that. So they are certainly, you know, have declared their ownership of that area, right? And so, yeah, the kids there and the people there, they are in a way occupying it, right? And in that sense, I mean, they're the underdog in the conversation, aren't they?
Oh, no question. A bunch of unemployed, in debt students and older, hardcore, principled activists willing to take risks are always going to be the underdog going up against billionaires and quasi and hope to be billionaires making decisions that affect the global economy. There's no question. But I think you're right that in taking over this square and reclaiming public space and how they are behaving in it, there is a great deal being accomplished as well in sort of a microcosm of democracy. I mean, you're seeing people learn about nonviolent resistance, about politics and ideologies and policies, and about democracy as a lived experience where people are having input and voting and making decisions democratically there in a square. And you see young people learn more in such activities than they learn from lectures and conferences, primarily because none of them go to lectures and conferences. I'm going to be speaking in Washington, D.C. at the Take Back the Dream conference, and I'll be speaking about nothing other than the need for that group to join in with the October 2011 activities. But I expect I won't see a lot of students at the Take Back the Dream conference. I won't see a lot of poor people. I will see at this conference, as any other conference, elderly, white, wealthy slant on who's attending. You know, a conference where you have to spend hundreds of dollars a night just for the hotel room. And we will bring more young people together and learn more from each other with, you know, $0 rent, living in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., starting on Thursday. And, you know, young people take a lot of heat for not being active these days, and they have the same excuses everybody else does in terms of economic pressures and the rest of it. But they do get active if you do something that looks useful, you know, sitting around and talking when the world is in crisis doesn't look useful to young people. It looks insane. You know, when we're destroying the natural habitat, when we are risking nuclear proliferation and we're engaging in massive killings through these wars, it just doesn't look sane to sit around and talk about it or raise funds for an election. It looks like it's something that needs action immediately. And so this is encouraging.
The people I've been meeting lately, you know, who are workers that I happen to start a conversation with about this, immediately, it's almost as if I'm getting the sense that there's been this national and maybe international or even global, you know, kind of stepping off the treadmill, as it were, you know, and people are kind of climbing out of the hamster cage, you know, and saying, wait a minute, I'm 2 weeks away from retirement. You're going to take my job away now? Or that's happening to their friend, or they've heard a horror story and they're aware that this is not leading anywhere that they can find a sustainable life for themselves and their family in, you know? So there's this conversation that's happening anyway. And it isn't any longer just, you know, quiet, you know, sort of cynicism. It's morphed. It's morphed into an energy that is more of a demand. And I think that this is why the Occupation Wall Street effort and all these people and what they've said has resonated so much with me. It's that it's my personal experience, too, of what I'm living here in Connecticut.
Right. It's a combination of people's personal experience and people finding out that it's everybody else's personal experience, too, because you don't know that. You don't know that from television news or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. And so that's why these things can snowball. You know, we aren't going to get progressively a little bit more resistance and activism as the economy progressively gets worse and worse. It's going to snowball. It's going to avalanche as people come to realize both that it's everybody else's experience too, that we're systemically in trouble. It's not my personal failings. The system is giving us all a bad hand. And to some extent, even, you know, closed-in Americans are learning that other countries, for all the problems they're having, in many cases, to a great extent, have things a lot better than we do. And it is possible. It is possible to have a decent education system and healthcare system and safety net. And you don't have to put all of your money into making banksters into multi-billionaires and funding new shiny wars every few months. There are choices. So I think that this is a teachable moment, as they say. This is an opportunity.
When you say a teachable moment, that was my sort of gut reaction, was to start taking notes about things that I've been thinking about anyway, because for the last 3 or 4 years now, I've been researching the market. My purpose in all that was to try to help my husband with his 401k that he wound up rolling over into an IRA and trying to rescue like everyone else did back in 2008. And it really seemed to him that it had gotten basically nowhere over many years, where other people have essentially used his money, and it got him nothing. So
that's right.
And what I realized ultimately, I wound up getting some pretty sophisticated information from people here and there that were working with me. We wound up involved in an online trading, page. And so now we can log on and we can watch the world's trades being made in one of these programs that they offer. And we can see the bids and we can see these supercomputers in action as they buy millions of shares at a time, as they make stocks go way up suddenly and way down suddenly,
Mm-hmm.
And they're making money with every dollar because their supercomputers trade so quickly. And what's happening is just a siphoning off of everybody's profits into their bank accounts, into the bank accounts of hedge funds, hedge fund managers, and also these monolithic now financial firms that do all this international trading.
And it's shameless, and it's not considered morally despicable. It's not considered criminal. It's considered laudatory. I mean, we admire these people who make a living off the sweat of others and don't work for it because they've managed to make a living. I mean, there's something very twisted about this common ideology. In the first Gilded Age, we had robber barons, but they had some guilt, and they invested in libraries and peace movements. And now there's just no shame. And there's a competition to become the biggest, most grotesque of multi-billionaires. It's reprehensible. And so to the extent that we can even start a conversation that Occupy Wall Street and then October 2011 can start a conversation about what the richest 1% and their hangers-on are doing to the rest of us, and how inexcusable it is, no matter, whether, as is the case with many of them, they got their wealth from their mommy and daddy, or they earned it through some, cutthroat practices. However they came about having that money, there is no moral excuse whatsoever for hoarding it, while people starve and suffer and die from preventable diseases and lack of resources. I mean, it's just inexcusable, and yet it's a conversation that we haven't even started to have yet.
David Swanson's website is davidswanson.org. He's author of the books Daybreak in America and War is a Lie. The website for the occupation of Washington, D.C. and Liberty Plaza can be found at october2011.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org is our website. Our music is by Fritz Heed. You can write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.